Hello and welcome back to this digital lecture on physical chemistry of polymers. This is its second lesson unit focusing on ideal chains. In the last lesson unit, we have seen what polymers are, namely a special case of large molecules, so-called macromolecules, that are chain-type molecules built up of a repeating sequence of monomeric segmental units. And we have seen the general intent of the field of physical chemistry of polymers, which is to derive fundamental structure-property relations for polymers, because this allows doing the reverse in rational polymeric materials design. For that purpose, we need to have a description of polymeric structures. And this is a complex endeavor, because polymers, as we have also seen in our last lesson unit, are complex multibodied systems. In this present lesson unit, it is our goal to get to know a very first and simplifying approach to tackle this challenge, which will be achieved by considering the most simple imaginable model for polymers, the ideal chain. This is like at the beginning of your education in fundamental physical chemistry, where you started your endeavor in describing the world of matter by considering the most ideal and most simple imaginable state of matter, the ideal gas. Let's recall. What were the cornerstones of the ideal gas model? Those were three. In the ideal gas model, we assume a state of matter constituted by point-like particles with no own volume and without interactions. Modeling that ideal state in the framework of the kinetic theory of gases leads to a strikingly simple but very powerful equation of state, the ideal gas law, featuring a mechanical energy on the left-hand side and a thermal energy on the right-hand side. PV equals nRT. Pressure times volume equals molar number of molecules times elementary gas constant times absolute temperature. In this present lesson unit now, we will do something very similar and model an ideal polymer chain to be composed of monomeric segments without any own volume and without interactions. From this modeling, as we will see later on in the following lesson unit, we will receive an equation of state that is strikingly similar, both mathematically and conceptually, to the ideal gas law. So, let's get started with that. What can we say intuitively about the shape of a polymeric chain? Well, we know that the shape of a polymer, which is a chain molecule composed of a repeating sequence of monomeric units, must be determined by three factors, as illustrated in figure 13a. The first one is the length of the elementary monomeric unit plus the bond that connects it to the next. For example, in a covalently jointed carbon-based backbone chain, such as in polyethylene, where the segmental repeating unit is actually just a methylene group, the length of such a segmental unit is 1.5 angstroms, corresponding to 0.15 nanometers, which is the length of a carbon-carbon single bond, as probably or hopefully known to you from your elementary classes in organic chemistry. Second, the shape of the resulting polymeric chain is determined by the monomeric bonding angle, which in the case of a carbon-based backbone chain is 109 degrees for an sp3 hybridized carbon-carbon single bond. Third, on top of that, another angle comes into play, which is the monomer bond torsion angle. Out of these three factors, the first two ones are fixed and set by the chemistry of the chain backbone. The third factor, however, is not fixed, because single bonds can easily rotate around the bonding axis. That means the macroscopic conformation of a polymer chain will result from the microscopic sequence of monomer bond torsional angles. As a result, a polymer chain can adopt many different local microconformations, resulting in many different macroscopic conformations. That means resulting in many different shapes, depending on what the sequence of local monomer bond torsional angles is. Let's look at two extremes to illustrate this to us. The first extreme is to consider an all-trans chain. That means every single monomeric segmental torsional angle is in the trans conformation. That means the most wide local arrangement. The macroscopic result of that sequence of microconformations will be a rod-shaped object, as shown in figure 13b. This state is one that exhibits a high degree of macroscopic order, and as such, it comes along with a disfavorable low entropy. We can get a second notion on that from an alternative viewpoint angle, based on a statistical argument. Every local microconformation is a microstate. The overall chain macroconformation that results from the sequence of microconformations is a macrostate. The macrostate of a rod-shaped polymeric chain is realized by only one setting, by only one arrangement of microstates, namely the one where all bonds are in their trans conformation. That means there is only one setting or arrangements of microconformations, or microstates, that realize the macroconformation, or macrostate, of a rod-shaped chain. This comes along with a disfavorable low entropy, corresponding to a high degree of order. The other extreme is a chain that features a wild mix of local cis and trans microconformations, as shown in figure 13c. The macroscopic result of that is a random coil macroconformation, meaning a random coil macroscopic shape of the polymeric chain. This comes along with a low degree of order, as also visible from figure 13c, and therewith with a high entropy. Again, we can have an alternative view on that also, again based on statistical arguments, which is as follows. The macroconformation of a random coil is realized by a large number of settings or permutations or arrangements of local cis and trans conformations, meaning microstates. That means the macroscopic state of a random coil is realized by a large number of microstates, which, according to statistical thermodynamics, corresponds to a high entropy. That means, from an entropic perspective, we would expect the random coil to be the conformation of choice for a polymer. However, as always in thermodynamics, there is also an energy side to the argument. In our case at hand, this comes from the circumstance that certain local monomer bond conformations are energetically more favorable than others, as it's visualized in figure 14. This is a figure that you certainly know from your elementary classes in organic chemistry. What we see here is the potential energy as a function of the bond torsional angle for butane, which can exist in different local conformations. Several characteristics of them are denoted here. These are the cis conformation, the Gauche minus and Gauche plus conformations, the anti-conformation, and the trans conformation. The most favorable conformation is the trans conformation, which denotes the energy minimum in figure 14, which has a set value of 0 here. In contrast to that, the most disfavorable conformation is the cis conformation, which denotes the energy maximum relative to this minimum in figure 14. When looking on the numbers on the energy axis, however, we see that even the most severe differences, namely the difference between the trans and the cis states, comes along with an energy difference of only about 17 kilojoules per mole. When we recall our first lesson unit in that context, we see that this is only about 7 times RT at room temperature. This means this energy gap is not overly high. If we compare the local minima, the trans, to the Gauche state, this is even a lot less. This is only 3 kilojoules per mole, which is only slightly above RT at room temperature at all. So that is in the reach of what is thermally activated. And also the conformational change between these states, for example, from the trans to the Gauche, must overcome an energy hump, an energy of activation barrier, of only about 13 kilojoules per mole, which is just roughly 5 times RT at room temperature. That means all those conformations shown in this diagram are energetically different, but these differences are not overly high, which in turn means they are all more or less equally well able to be populated. Furthermore, due to the low energies of activation barriers between them, changes of local conformations happen fast and easily. Which is one of the prime reasons, by the way, why polymers above their glass transition temperature are flexible. This is different if there is more severe energetic spacing and higher energetic barriers between the states, which comes into play if there is more bulky substituents along the chain backbone that are hard to be rotated against each other in the attempt of bond torsion. This will then come along with a more pronounced favoring of the wide translocal conformation over the closer Gauche or even cis local conformations. And on top of that, this causes little chain flexibility, which we, for example, see if we compare the glass transition temperatures of polystyrene and polyethylene, which is a reflection of the less easy rotatability of the bulky phenyl substituent in polystyrene as compared to the just minimally bulky hydrogen atoms along the chain backbone in polyethylene. See, here we already have a very first glimpse on a structure-property relation. Overall, however, the energetic effects are rather negligible, so entropy prevails in this discussion, and the entropic aspect is dominant in determining the most likely shape of a polymeric chain. And that means the most probable structure of a synthetic polymer chain is that of a flexible random coil. Why did I insert the adjective synthetic here? Because the situation can be, and in fact is, different if we consider some natural polymers. The prime example of that are proteins. In proteins, in quite harsh contrast to synthetic homopolymers, the energy side of the argument dominates. Because in those biopolymers, there is a highly specific, distinct energy minimum corresponding to one specific three-dimensional conformation, which is energetically highly favored over the others. It is established and stabilized in energy by delicate multivalent secondary interactions, which form local ordered structures such as alpha helices and beta sheets. The purpose of doing this in nature is to realize a three-dimensional shape that offers specific pockets for specific target molecules to fit into and bind to and then to be reacted. This is what we commonly refer to as key and lock principle. For synthetic Haber polymers, however, entropy is prevalent and the random coil shape is the most probable structure. How can we describe such a structure mathematically? When we intend to do that, we find ourselves confronted to a challenge, which is the large number of microconformations that can exist. Even if we restrict ourselves to the energetically most favored trans and gauche conformations, which are three, namely the trans, the gauche minus, and the gauche plus ones, there are 3 to the power of n minus 2 microconformations that result for a chain composed of n segmental units. And if we calculate that through for a polymer with, let's say, 100 segments, which is still a comparably short polymer, this results in 6 times 10 to the 46 different conformations that are possible for that chain. We see this number is way beyond analytical reach. Furthermore, the change between these different local microstates is fast, as the energy humps between them are low. And if we put that into, for example, an Ehring-type equation to calculate a rate constant for conformational change, we end up with numbers of just a few inverse nanoseconds. That means we have no chance in assessing that problem analytically. What we need instead is suitable average values. There's basically 2 average values to assess the size of polymeric objects, such as random coils, that are common and popular in polymer science. These are the so-called end-to-end distance and the radius of duration, as both visualized in figure 15. The end-to-end distance, as the name already says, is the distance measured from one chain end to the other. Mathematically, it's obtained by simply summing up the individual bond vectors, as indicated also in figure 15a. As easy as this appears theoretically, this quantity is in fact very hard to assess experimentally. To do this, we need a method that is somehow capable of detecting the 2 chain ends and measuring the distance between them. One method that is able to do so is fluorescence resonance energy transfer. If we label the 2 chain ends with fluorophores, the one being an energy donor and the other one being an energy acceptor, we can excite the donor by irradiation with a suitable light wavelength, and then there can be energy transfer from the donor to the acceptor, causing the acceptor to fluoresce. And the extent of energy transfer is detectable by the fluorescence intensity and also time-resolved decay pattern, which depends on the mutual distance of these fluorophores. And so that's a way to probe the chain end distance. You see already that this is a very tedious method. The most tedious aspect is to label the chain ends such that one carries a donor and the other carries an acceptor. Due to this complication in assessing this quantity experimentally, it is not so much beloved by polymer science experimentalists. By contrast, people from the theory community like this quantity very much, because it's easy to calculate. All we need is to sum up bonding vectors, as it's expressed in equation 2.1. The other average quantity that is often used is the so-called radius of duration, as visualized in figure 15b. This quantity is calculated by a weighted sum of all mass segments in our coil. We take the mass of every monomeric unit, which ideally is always the same for all units, and add these masses together, each weighted by its distance from the center of mass of the coil square. Normalizing this to the total mass of the object gives us the radius of duration square. We can also do this calculation continuously by replacing the discrete sum by a continuous integral, as done in equation 2.2. The chain end-to-end distance, as visualized in figure 15a, has a quite illustrative meaning. Do we also have such an illustrative meaning for the radius of duration? Actually, yes. The radius of duration has to do with the radius that a spherical object with the same moment of inertia and the same density as our actual object of interest would have. That means if we say this polymer has a radius of duration of, let's say, 20 nanometers, a solid, dense sphere with the same moment of inertia as our polymer coil and the same density would have a radius of 20 nanometers. In German wording, the radius of duration is also named Gyrationsradius or Trägheitsradius, as it has to do with the moment of inertia, dem Trägheitsmoment. It is noteworthy here that the radius of duration is a quantity not only limited to linear chains, but also applicable and calculable for nonlinear chains, such as branched or dendritic polymers. It can actually be calculated for any geometrical object. We can calculate it for a chair or a table or a pen or whatever. The outcome of this calculation, which in those cases has to be done continuously via the integral, is the size of a dense spherical object with the same moment of inertia and the same density as our actual irregular object of interest. By comparing equations 2.2 and 2.1, we can see illustratively that the radius of gyration is somewhat more complicated to be calculated than the end-to-end distance. This is the reason why polymer theory people often not so much prefer to work with the radius of gyration, but rather take the end-to-end distance as the measure. For experimentalists, by contrast, it's just the inverse. They very much like the radius of gyration because it's easy to be determined experimentally. Because in contrast to the complicated-to-estimate end-to-end distance, the radius of gyration is actually easy to be determined experimentally, as we will see in the almost last lesson unit of the second part of this lecture series, Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2. A method that delivers it quite easily is static light scattering, which is experimentally not overly demanding. Of course, these two average measures of the polymer coil size are related to each other and can be translated into one another by relations like the ones laid down in Table 4. Now that we know two suitable average values to describe the size of a polymer chain, let's see whether we can come up with some ab initio estimation of these quantities. We will do so by considering a variety of model approaches, starting with the simplest one, which is named the random chain, also referred to as phantom chain, or the freely jointed chain model. This is the most simple model we can think about to describe the shape of a polymer chain. It is based on the premise that both the bond torsional angle and even the monomer bonding angle are free in a polymer chain. That means the local monomer bonds can have any torsional angle and also even any bonding angle between them, up to even unrealistic bonding angles such as zero. Due to this very harsh simplifying assumption, the model is referred to as phantom chain model, because with this freedom for the chain to arrange itself, different monomer segments can actually and even occupy the same spots in space, penetrating through each other like ghosts or phantoms. With this very simplified model, we get a very simplified equation for the square value of the chain end-to-end distance. Why do we use the square here? Well, we do so to get rid of the directional dependence. And why do we do that? Because we have pointed out already in our first lesson unit that irregularity, distributions, and polydispersity are pronounced in polymers. So is it with the chain end-to-end distance. If we consider an ensemble of multiple chains, certainly not all of them will have the same end-to-end distance. There will be a distribution of chain end-to-end distances instead. Even if we consider just one single chain, the rapid conformational fluctuation will cause a time-dependent distribution of the chain end-to-end distance. As a result, what we are interested in is actually the average end-to-end distance. However, if we would take the average of the vector quantity, it would always turn out to be zero, because in an ensemble of multiple representations of that vector quantity, be it an ensemble average or a time average, there will always be pairs of vectors that have the same length but opposite directions, and all these pairs would cancel out to zero upon averaging. To circumvent this triviality, what we do is we first eliminate the directional dependence by taking the square of the vectors, and then calculating their average. We have seen in Figure 15a that the way of how we calculate the end-to-end distance vector is by simply summing up the individual bonding vectors. So that means if we want to calculate the square of it, we simply have to take the sum of the squared bonding vectors, as expressed in equation 2.3a. We can write out the square of a vector sum by writing out the scalar product, which gives us equation 2.3b. In the next step, we now take the average, because as we have just said, with the calculation so far up to equation 2.3b, we only would get a momentary, random realization of the square end-to-end distance. But what we are actually interested in is the average over it, which then leads us to a so-called mean square quantity. In our case, the mean square chain end-to-end distance. In that calculation now, a fortunate circumstance comes into play. Namely, the sum term of the cosines of the bonding angle in equation 2.3b turns out to be zero upon averaging. Because in the phantom chain model, this angle is random. And if we average over an ensemble of cosines of a random argument, the average will be zero. Because the cosine is an oscillatory function with values between minus 1 and plus 1 symmetrically distributed around zero, and the average of those functional values at a random argument with enough representations is just zero. Well then, if this average of the cosine is zero, we could just simply leave out the sum term over it, which leaves us only the first half of equation 2.3b, the sum of the squares of the bond vector lengths. This sum is composed of n summands for a chain with n segments, and that means the final result is just n times L squared, as expressed by equation 2.4. Hence, what we get from this simple estimate is a simple power law dependence for the mean squared chain end-to-end distance of a random coil as a function of the number of chain segments out of which it is composed. We can also linearize this quantity by just taking the root, which will then, by the way, also transform it back to physical dimensions from square meters to linear meters. And the outcome of that is named root mean square chain end-to-end distance. This exhibits a scaling with a number of segments with a power of 1/2, as expressed by equation 2.5. You may recall a seemingly far away, but nevertheless actually very close, related scaling law from your elementary classes in physical chemistry, which is the time dependence of the mean square displacement of a randomly walking diffusing particle. This scaling is expressed by the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation, 2.6, that says that the mean square end-to-end distance of a random walker scales linearly with time, or, as expressed in a square root fashion, the root mean square displacement scales with time with a power of 1/2. If we assume such a random walk of a diffusing particle or molecule to be composed of a sequence of distinct steps, distinct jumps, for example, each of which having an elementary duration of a time period tau, we can express the per se continuous variable t, time, also as a sort of number of steps here. With that, equation 2.6 and 2.5 display striking similarity. Although seemingly at a first glance, the shape of a random polymer coil and the trajectory of a randomly walking diffusing molecule or particle, as shown in figure 16, seem to be very different. We can conclude from the similarity of the outcome, however, that apparently these processes are not so different. And actually, in our next lesson unit, we will rely on and adopt this similarity to go further in our discussion. We can conclude from this treatment that in the phantom chain model, we make some very simplifying assumptions, but also end up with a very simple, and simple generally always means powerful in physical chemistry, equation for the size of such an ideal polymer coil. Let's go a little more towards reality. The most severe approximation that we have made in the phantom chain or random chain model was certainly that we have a free bonding angle. This is something we of course know is not the case. The bonding angle is determined by the chain backbone specific chemistry. It is 109.6 degrees for a tetrahedrically shaped sp3 hybridized carbon-carbon single bond. Taking this into account in the mathematical equations is actually not overly complicated. The way of how we can do this is to make ourselves clear that each bonding vector along the chain projects a cosine component of its length onto the next following one. The mathematical treatment of that recursive projection can be done by a series expansion, which for the sake of simplicity and conciseness, I don't want to detail here at this point. If you're interested in that, you can find this in the textbook Polymer Physics by Rubinstein and Kolbe. The result of this series expansion is outlined in equation 2.7. Herein, we basically retain our scaling law that the mean square end-to-end distance scales with n times L square. And what comes newly and additionally into play is a factor that accounts for the fixed bonding angle. This factor is 1 minus cosine of that angle over 1 plus cosine of that angle. To get a feeling about some numbers, if we calculate this for an sp3 hybridized carbon bonding angle, this additional factor is roughly 2. This means that we underestimate the polymer coil's mean square end-to-end distance by a factor of 2 in the realm of the phantom random chain, meaning if we disregard its fixed bonding angle. With this mathematical treatment approach, we have made the step from the random chain model to the so-called freely rotating chain model. This chain is no longer free in its bonding angle, but still free in its monomer bond torsional angle. It's free to rotate around the segmental bonds. In the same sense, we can go even further towards reality and also take into account the actually not even totally free bond torsional rotation angle. This angle is not strictly fixed, but has certain energetically preferred realizations. We can account for this energetic favoring by calculating an integral over a Boltzmann term of the torsional potential energy diagram that was shown in figure 14 and adding this to our chain end-to-end distance formula. The result is equation 2.9. With that, we have made a further step from the freely rotating chain model to the model of a chain with hindered rotation. The outcome formula relies on the former and further expands it. It still retains the n times l square scaling part, the bonding angle part that we have just introduced before, and now also features an additional new factor that accounts for the favorable average bond torsional angle. This latter factor is sometimes referred to as the obstruction parameter in literature, abbreviated by the symbol sigma square, as it has to do with the obstruction of bond rotatability. That has to do with the bulkiness of substituents along the polymer chain backbone. The more energy is needed for a conformational change, the higher is this value. Even more frequently in literature, the two additional factors that we have introduced, the one that has to do with a preferred monomer bonding torsional angle and the other that has to do with a fixed monomer bonding angle, are summarized and named characteristic ratio. The characteristic ratio, therefore, includes and mathematizes all chemistry-specific parameters in a form as shown in equation 2.10. With that, we can generalize our scaling law for the mean square end-to-end distance of a random coil to C infinity times n times L square. C infinity in that equation is the characteristic ratio. It is large for stiff polymers, which have bulky or light charge substituents along the backbone that want to have, that prefer to have a certain distance to each other, and that are hard to rotate against each other on cost of this distance. By contrast, that value is low for flexible polymers that have unbulky and uncharged substituents along the chain backbone. Figure 17 summarizes some examples of this value as a function of the number of segments in a chain. With that, it also shows to us that the value C infinity is first dependent on that parameter. It first depends on the number of monomeric segments in the chain, meaning the chain degree of polymerization, but then after about 100 repeating units, levels off in a plateau. This is what the index infinity in the symbol for C infinity refers to. In that realm where it has leveled off, it spans quite a broad range of values. It is logically one for the most simple example of polyethylene conceived as a very ideal random phantom chain, but it has values of 6 or 8 or even 10 for actual polymers. So we see that the radius of these coils is actually quite a lot larger than the one we would estimate if we would take the most simplifying random chain model to treat them. When considering the resulting general scaling equation, R square is C infinity times n times L square, we recognize again the cooperative convergence of universality and specificity. Whereas the part of the equation with n times L square is universal physics and applies in that form to all polymers, the part with C infinity denotes the chemical specificity of a given polymer at hand. What we have done to this point is we have taken up a very simple model and more refined it to come closer to reality. Along with that, the model got more complicated. Wouldn't it be beautiful if we had both a model that has a simple mathematical appearance and accounts for all the reality? A congenious approach to realize both has been introduced by Hans Kuhn in the framework of the Kuhn model. What is done in this model is shown in figure 18. A certain number of bonds, which doesn't have to be a natural number, by the way, is summed up and taken together as a new conceptual longer elementary unit. The shape of the chain is then no longer given by the many actual short monomer units, but by the few newly introduced conceptual longer monomeric units. A specific polymer with a specific number n and a specific length l of segments thereby transitions into a random Kuhn polymer that is no longer composed of n actual units of length l each, but instead of nk conceptual units of length lk each. In the end, this new conceptual chain has the same chain end-to-end distance as the original one, but the way of conceiving it to be composed of new conceptual structural units results in an overcoming of the fixed bonding angles. Instead, the new hypothetic longer conceptual structural units display any imaginable bonding angles between them, possibly even values of 180 degrees or 0 degrees, all present as a wild random mixture, as shown in figure 18. So, the ingenious element of that approach is that the chemical specificity of a given polymer at hand is incorporated into the model by normalizing its number n and length l of the repeating units to the characteristic ratio, which is the quantity capturing the coil's chemical specificity, and that way we sort of zoom out our view onto the polymer to a level where that chemical specificity is no longer seen, but instead we then see a universalized random coil exhibiting a simplified specified size scaling that is universalized to the general n times l square scaling form. This is laid down in equation 2.11. In summary, we can say that the physical meaning of this model is the following. The characteristic ratio represents the chemical specificity of a given polymer. It is large for stiff chains and small for flexible chains. In the Kuhn concept, we renormalize N and L, meaning the number and length of segments in the chain, by that very quantity. That way, each polymer is normalized to or forgets its chemical identity, but instead, as a result, displays universal scaling and can therefore be universally conceived or described as a random phantom chain. That means with the Kuhn concept, we have somehow reversed or traced back our more and more complex approach to its very simplistic origin, the phantom chain model. We can also do the opposite and try to find a maximally realistic expression for the value of C infinity of a given specific chain at hand. This is done in the so-called RIS model, the rotational isomeric states model. What this concept does is, it explicitly considers the energies of the most relevant torsional bonding angle states, the trans, the gauche plus, and the gauche minus, as expressed by the potential energy diagram displayed in figure 14. And then, in the framework of the RIS model, we calculate a Boltzmann term of that potential energy function to express the relative population numbers of these distinct states, as expressed in equation 2.12 and visualized graphically in figure 20. The RIS model even goes further and appraises how the conformation of a given local bond I determines the one of the sequentially following the preceding bond I plus 1. So this model quantifies to us how many dyads of type trans-trans, trans-gauche, or gauche-gauche are present in the chain by quantifying the relative energies of these different combinations and then translating those into relative population numbers. This is shown to us in table 5. Let's have a secondary, a more conceptual view onto equation 2.12. What this equation expresses is the ratio of population numbers of gauche and translocal conformations, depending on their energy difference relative to thermal energy. If that ratio of delta E over RT is high, then this means it is favorable for the chain to adopt the energetically most favorable macro conformation, which can be the all trans state, as we've discussed earlier in this lesson unit, or if this is precluded by the bulkiness of the substituents along the chain backbone that must somehow be favorably arranged against each other, which potentially may require them to be at greater mutual distances than they would be in an all trans conformation. This can also be alternating sequences of kind trans-gauche, 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 or trans-trans-gauche-gauche, trans-trans-gauche-gauche, or whatsoever, or something like that. What we get in this limit is an energy-based control of the chain structure, which will then be ordered and well-defined. By contrast, at a low ratio of delta E over RT in the Boltzmann term, the chain adopts the entropically most favorable conformation, which is that of a random coil. A related ratio is that of the energy of activation for torsional change over RT. This ratio corresponds to the height of the energy barrier between different monomer bond torsional states, such as the trans and the gauche states. If that ratio is high, we have to do with stiff polymer chains, whereas if this ratio is low, we are dealing with flexible polymer chains. What is directly reflected in this ratio, by the way, is the polymer's glass transition temperature, which is the temperature underneath which all main chain dynamics is frozen, or vice versa, which is the temperature above which main chain dynamics is activated. This temperature is high for the case of stiff chains that have a high ratio of the energy of activation of local bond torsion over thermal energy RT, and this temperature is low for flexible polymer chains, which have a low ratio of the energy of activation for bond torsion relative to RT. What we have with that is the fundament for a structure property relation. All these latter equations are dependent on temperature. Not only because temperature is a variable parameter in the denominator of the Boltzmann terms of these equations, but also due to the very fundamental thermodynamic principle delta G is delta H minus T delta S, as denoted in equation 2.13. We have just discussed a battle of energy against entropy. Energy prevails in chains in which certain microconformations are a lot more favorable than the others, whereas entropy prevails in chains where this is not the case. The entropy term, as always in thermodynamics, gets more pronunciation with higher temperature, as it comes along with a T in the fundamental equation 2.13, which features minus T delta S. That means an increase of temperature makes the coil more disordered. First of all, because local microconformational change is then better activated, and on top of that, because it then becomes more favorable to equally distribute the different possible local microconformations. By contrast, at low temperature, the entropy term has a low significance, and the energy term instead dominates the equation and therewith the polymer shape. Not only because then changes between the different conformations are hard to achieve, but also because then a certain sequence of microconformations, such as the all-trans one, is a lot more favorable than the others. Little footnote in this context. In classical physical chemistry, you may have taken on the message that entropy is disorder. This is indeed reflected here. A random polymer coil indeed is the most disordered state we can think about, whereas all trans, or regularly alternating sequences of trans and gauche, are highly ordered. The random coil therefore has a high entropy, whereas a chain constituted of an ordered sequence of local bond conformations has a low entropy. In statistical thermodynamics, in general, there is an alternative viewpoint on the same matter with the same outcome. This is that entropy is maximal for a macrostate with a high number of microconformations, of microstates that realize it. Again, we also see this reflected here. The random coil is realized by a lot more microconformations than an ordered chain, such as an all-trans chain, for example. Together, these two representations of entropy can lead us to a new conceptual illustration of it. Namely that entropy is freedom. The random coil has the greatest extent of freedom of arranging itself microscopically, whereas the all-trans chain has no freedom of arranging itself microscopically. We have seen from all the modeling that we have done that due to the fixed bonding angles and the somehow preferred conformational arrangements of the bonds in the chain, each local segment imparts a certain directional preference onto the next following one down the chain. In the RIS model, this preference has even been quantified. That means it takes a certain number of segments down the chain until the directional memory of a given first one is forgotten, so to speak. This directional memory is named persistence and quantified by the persistence length. Mathematically, this quantity can be defined as the projection of all following bond vectors, I plus J, that come after a given first one, I, down the chain. This is illustrated in figure 21 and mathematized in equation 2.14. Of course, this quantity, the persistence length, must have to do with a characteristic ratio because both are quantities that are large for stiff polymers and low for flexible polymers. How these two quantities are related to one another is quantified in equation 2.15. A further quantity that also expresses the same in this context is the normalized bond length from the Kuhn model, the Kuhn length. And equation 2.16 points out how that quantity is related to the two others that we have just discussed. To get some feeling about numbers, for polystyrene that has a characteristic ratio of about 10 and a monomer length of 1.5 angstroms, corresponding to 0.15 nanometers, we get a persistence length of about 9 angstroms, 0.9 nanometers. For double-stranded DNA, this is a lot larger. Double-stranded DNA has a persistence length of more than 60 nanometers, meaning more than 600 angstroms. The reason is quite obvious, as double-stranded DNA is a very, very stiff polymer due to its stiff double helix primary chain structure. Such polymers are no longer named flexible chains. Instead, they are referred to as semi-flexible or worm-like chains. For those chains, yet an alternative definition of the persistence length is used, as shown in figure 22. In summary, we can conclude that the most probable shape of a flexible homopolymer chain is that of a random coil. If we expand this model to incorporate the chemical specificity of the monomer segments by accounting for contributions of the fixed bonding angle, we get to the model of the freely rotating chain. And if we furthermore also account for the preferred realizations resulting in a certain average of the bond torsional angle, we get to the model of the chain with hindered rotation. All this chemical specificity can be captured by a quantity named characteristic ratio. And a congenious model introduced by Kuhn normalizes the monomer segmental length and the number of monomeric repeating units in a chain to that very quantity to re-universalize the chain statistics. Table number 6 presents us an overviewing summary of these different characteristic simple chain models that we have addressed in this lesson unit and their outcomes. To close this lesson, let's consider a number example. Let's consider the most simple polymer imaginable, polyethylene. And let's regard a chain of that kind, composed of 20,000 repeating units, each of which having length of 1.5 angstroms, or in other words, 0.15 nanometers. The characteristic ratio for polyethylene, taken from literature, is 6.87. What will be the root mean square end-to-end distance of that chain? This is easy to calculate. We take our scaling law, saying that the mean square end-to-end distance is C infinity times n times L square, and then we just take the square root of this to get the root mean square end-to-end distance. Plugging in the numbers, just given, leads us to a result of 57 nanometers. For comparison, let's also appraise what the length of this chain would be if we would fully stretch it all the way, which is the so-called contour length. The length of the chain measured all the way along the chain backbone contour from one end to the other. This is simply calculated. It's just number of segments times length of each segment, n times L. And plugging in the numbers in that gives us a contour length of 3080 nanometers. That means, whereas the coil could potentially be more than 3000 nanometers long if we would fully expand, fully decoil it, it actually has a size of only 57 nanometers in its natural coiled state. This tells us that flexible polymers are indeed heavily coiled. And it also tells us that the size of these coils falls right into the colloidal domain, which is one of the prerequisites to constitute an example of soft matter. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. We have laid down the fundament to model polymer structures. The very first step to do so was to consider a very simplifying model, which is the ideal chain, and limiting our focus to an average quantification of its size. We have seen along the way how this average value is determined by energetic and entropic aspects. Whereas energetic aspects favor a well-defined and ordered shape of the chain, entropic aspects, by contrast, favor a random coil. In our next lesson unit, we will carry this thought further and come to the insight that changing the chain end-to-end distance, which means deforming the polymer in a sense that bringing it from a state with high entropy, which is the random coil state, to a state with low entropy, which is a more expanded state, will create an entropy-based penalty. And we can guess intuitively already that this will have consequences. The consequence, as we will realize, is nothing less than one of the most important properties of polymers, which is their entropy-based chain elasticity. We can bring down the present lesson unit to a quote by the Italian soft matter scientist Roberto Piazza, who wrote a beautiful bedtime storybook entitled Soft Matter, the Stuff That Dreams Are Made Of. As an Italian, he compared polymers, which, as we have seen today, most predominantly adopt the shape of a random coil, to his country people by saying, "Polymers are like Italians, messy, but very flexible."